Chapter 51. A voice from the past. One afternoon, when the chestnuts were coming into flower, Maggie had brought her chair outside the front door and was seated there with a book on her knees. Her dark eyes had wandered from the book, but they did not seem to be enjoying the sunshine which pierced the screen of jasmine on the projecting porch at her right, and threw leafy shadows on her pale round cheek. They seemed rather to be searching for something that was not disclosed by the sunshine. It had been a more miserable day than usual. Her father, after a visit of Wackham's, had had a paroxysm of rage, in which for some trifling fault he had beaten the boy who served in the mill. Once before, since his illness, he had had a similar paroxysm, in which he had beaten his horse, and the scene had left a lasting terror in Maggie's mind. The thought had risen that some time or other he might beat her mother if she happened to speak in her feeble way at the wrong moment. The keenest of all dread with her was lest her father should add to his present misfortune the wretchedness of doing something irretrievably disgraceful. The battered schoolbook of Tom's which she held on her knees could give her no fortitude under the pressure of that dread. And again her eyes had filled with tears, as they wandered vaguely, seeing neither the chestnut trees, nor the distant horizon, but only future scenes of home sorrow. Suddenly she was roused by the sound of the opening gate, and of footsteps on the gravel. It was not Tom who was entering, but a man in a sealskin cap and a blue plush waistcoat, carrying a pack on his back, and followed closely by a bull terrier of brindled coat and defiant aspect. "Oh, Bob, it's you," said Maggie, starting up with a smile of pleased recognition, for there had been no abundance of kind acts to efface the recollection of Bob's generosity. "I'm so glad to see you." "Thank you, miss," said Bob, lifting his cap and showing a delighted face, but immediately relieving himself of some accompanying embarrassment by looking down at his dog and saying in a tone of disgust, "Get out, why you thunder and sonny." "My brother is not at home yet, Bob," said Maggie. "He is always at St. Ogg's in the daytime." "Well, miss," said Bob, "I should be glad to see Mr. Tom, but that isn't just what I'm come for. Look here." Bob was in the act of depositing his pack on the doorstep, and with it a row of small books fastened together with string. Apparently, however, they were not the object to which he wished to call Maggie's attention, but rather something which he had carried under his arm, wrapped in a red handkerchief. "See here," he said again, laying the red parcel on the others and unfolding it. "You won't think I may make it too free, miss, I hope, but I lighted on these books, and I thought they might make up to you a bit for them as you've lost. For I heard you speak o' pictures, and as for pictures, look here." The opening of the red handkerchief had disclosed a superannuated keepsake and six or seven numbers of a portrait gallery in Royal Octavo, and the emphatic request to look referred to a portrait of George IV in all the majesty of his depressed cranium and voluminous neckcloth. "There's all sorts o' gentlemen here," Bob went on, turning over the leaves with some excitement. "Why, all sorts o' nonnes, and some bald, and some wy wigs, Parliament gentlemen, I reckon. And here," he added, opening the epsic, "here's ladies for you, some why curly hair and some why smooth, and some a smiling why their heads o' one side, and some as if they were going to cry. Look here, a sitting on the ground out o' door, dressed like the ladies in scene get out o' the carriages at the balls in TH Old Hall there. My eyes, I wonder what the chaps wear as go a courting 'em. I sat up till the clock was gone 12 last night, a looking at 'em, I did, till they stared at me out o' the pictures, as if they'd know when I spoke to 'em. But, lors, I shouldn't know what to say to 'em. They'll be more fitting company for you, miss." And the man at the bookstall, he said they banged ivory thing for pictures. He said they was a first-rate article. "And you've bought them for me, Bob?" said Maggie, deeply touched by this simple kindness. "H, how very, very good of you. But I'm afraid you gave a great deal of money for them." "Not me," said Bob. I dodge have three times the money if they'll make up to you a bit for them as was sold away from you, miss. For I never forgot how you looked when you fretted about the books being gone. It stuck by me as if it was a picture engine before me. And when I see it the book open you owe the stall, why the lady looking out of it why eyes a bit like yarn when you was fretting, you'll excuse my taking the liberty, miss. I thought I'd make free to buy it for you, and then I bought the books full old gentleman to match. And then here Bob took up the small string packet of books thought you might like a bit more print as well as the pictures. And I got these for a say-so, they're cram full o' print, and I thought they'd do no harm coming along why these better most books. And I hope you won't say me nay, and tell me as you won't have 'em, like Mr. Tom did why the sovereigns. No, indeed. Bob, said Maggie, I'm very thankful to you for thinking of me, and being so good to me and Tom. I don't think anyone ever did such a kind thing for me before. I haven't many friends who care for me. Have a dog, miss. They're better friends nor any Christian, said Bob, laying down his pack again, which he had taken up with the intention of hurrying away. For he felt considerable shyness in talking to a young lass like Maggie, though, as he usually said of himself, his tongue overrun him, when he began to speak, I can't give you mumps, cause he'd break his heart, to go away from me, mumps, what do you say, you riffraff? Mumps declined to express himself more diffusely than by a single affirmative movement of his tail. But I'd get you a pup, miss, and welcome. No, thank you, Bob. We have a yard dog, and I mayn't keep a dog of my own. Eh, that's a pity, else there's a pup, if you didn't mind about it not being thoroughbred. Its mother acts in the Punch show, an uncommon sensible bitch. She means more sense why her bark, nor half the chaps can put into their talk from breakfast to sundown. There's one chap carries pots, a poor, low trade as any on the road. He says, why Toby's not but a mongrel, there's not to look at in her. Apostrophe apostrophe but I says to him, why, what are you yoursin but a mongrel? There wasn't much pickin' o' your feyther and mother, to look at you. Apostrophe apostrophe not, but I like a bit o' breed myself, but I can't abide to see one cur grinnin' at another. I wish you good evening, miss, said Bob, abruptly taking up his pack again, under the consciousness that his tongue was acting in an undisciplined manner. Won't you come in the evening sometime and see my brother, Bob? Said Maggie. Yes, miss, thank you another time. You'll give my duty to him, if you please. Eh, he's a fine growed chap, Mr. Tom is. He took to growing I the legs, and I didn't. The pack was down again now, the hook of the stick having somehow gone wrong. You don't call mumps a cur, I suppose? Said Maggie, divining that any interest she showed in mumps would be gratifying to his master. No, miss, a fine way off that, said Bob, with pitying smile. Mumps is as fine a cross as you'll see anywhere along the floss, and in been up at why the barge times eno. Why, the gentry stops to look at him. But you won't catch mumps a looking at the gentry much, he minds his own business, he does. The expression of mumps' face, which seemed to be tolerating the superfluous existence of objects in general, was strongly confirmatory of this high praise. He looks dreadfully surly, said Maggie. W would he let me pat him? Eh, that would he, and thank you. He knows his company, mumps does. He isn't a dog as I'll be caught why gingerbread. He'd smell a thief a good deal stronger nor the gingerbread, he would. Lors, I talk to him by th hour together, when I'm walking I lone places, and if in done a bit o' mischief, I allays tell him. In got no secrets, but what mumps knows him. He knows about my big thumb, he does. Your big thumb what's that, Bob? Said Maggie. That's what it is, miss, said Bob, quickly, exhibiting a singularly broad specimen of that difference between the man and the monkey. I it tells I measuring out the flannel, you see. I carry flannel, cause it's light for my pack, and it's dear stuff, you see, so a big thumb tells. I clap my thumb at the end o' the yard and cut o' the hither side of it, and the old women are dubtot. But Bob, said Maggie, looking serious, that's cheating. I don't like to hear you say that. Don't you, miss? Said Bob regretfully. Then I'm sorry I said it. But I'm so used to talking to mumps, and he doesn't mind a bit o' cheating, when it's them skinflint women, as haggle and haggle, and I'd like to get their flannel for nothing, and I'd never ask theirselves how I got my dinner out on. I never cheat anybody as doesn't want to cheat me, miss. Lors, I'm a honest chap, I am. Only I must have a bit o' sport, and now I don't go YTH ferrets, ain't got no varmint to come over but them haggling women. I wish you good evening, miss. Goodbye, Bob. Thank you very much for bringing me the books. And come again to see Tom. Yes, miss, said Bob, moving on a few steps. Then turning half round he said, I'll leave off that trick why my big thumb, if you don't think well on me for it, miss. But it 'ud be a pity, it would. I couldn't find another trick so good, and what 'ud be the use o' having a big thumb? It might as well ha' been narrow. Maggie, thus exalted into Bob's exalting Madonna, laughed in spite of herself, at which her worshipper's blue eyes twinkled too, and under these favoring auspices he touched his cap and walked away. The days of chivalry are not gone, notwithstanding Burke's grand dirge over them. They live still in that far-off worship paid by many a youth, and man to the woman of whom he never dreams that he shall touch, so much as her little finger, or the hem of her robe. Bob, with the pack on his back, had as respectful an adoration for this dark-eyed maiden, as if he had been a knight in armor calling aloud on her name as he pricked on to the fight. That gleam of merriment soon died away from Maggie's face, and perhaps only made the returning gloom deeper by contrast. She was too dispirited, even to like answering questions about Bob's present of books, and she carried them away to her bedroom, laying them down there and seating herself on her one stool, without caring to look at them just yet. She leaned her cheek against the window frame, and thought that the light-hearted Bob had a lot much happier than hers. Maggie's sense of loneliness, and utter privation of joy, had deepened with the brightness of advancing spring. All the favorite outdoor nooks about home, which seemed to have done their part with her parents in nurturing and cherishing her, were now mixed up with the home sadness, and gathered no smile from the sunshine. Every affection, every delight the poor child had, was like an aching nerve to her. There was no music for her anymore, no piano, no harmonized voices, no delicious stringed instruments, with their passionate cries of imprisoned spirits sending a strange vibration through her frame. And of all her school life there was nothing left her now, but her little collection of school books, which she turned over with a sickening sense that she knew them all, and they were all barren of comfort. Even at school as he had often wished for books with more in them, everything she learned there seemed like the ends of long threads that snapped immediately. And now without the indirect charm of school emulation telemaic was mere bran, so were the hard, dry questions on Christian doctrine. There was no flavor in them, no strength. Sometimes Maggie thought she could have been contented with absorbing fancies, if she could have had all Scott's novels and all Byron's poems. Then, perhaps, she might have found happiness enough to dull her sensibility to her actual daily life. And yet they were hardly what she wanted. She could make dream worlds of her own, but no dream world would satisfy her now. She wanted some explanation of this hard real life, the unhappy-looking father, seated at the dull breakfast table, the childish, bewildered mother, the little sordid tasks that filled the hours, or the more oppressive emptiness of weary joyless leisure, the need of some tender, demonstrative love, the cruel sense that Tom didn't mind what she thought or felt, and that they were no longer playfellows together, the privation of all pleasant things that had come to her more than to others. She wanted some key that would enable her to understand, and in understanding, to endure the heavy weight that had fallen on her young heart. If S.E. had been taught ill learning and wisdom, such as great men knew, she thought she should have held the secrets of life. If S.E. had only books, that she might learn for herself what wise men knew. Saints and martyrs had never interested Maggie, so much as sages and poets. She knew little of saints and martyrs, and had gathered, as a general result of her teaching, that they were a temporary provision against the spread of Catholicism, and had all died at Smithfield. In one of these meditations it occurred to her that S.E. had forgotten Tom's schoolbooks, which had been sent home in his trunk. But she found the stock unaccountably shrunk down to the few old ones which had been well thumbed, the Latin dictionary and grammar, a Delectus, a Tourneotropius, the well-worn Virgil, Aldrich's Logic, and the exasperating Euclid. Still, Latin, Euclid, and Logic would surely be a considerable step in masculine wisdom, in that knowledge which made men contented, and even glad to live. Not that the yearning for effectual wisdom was quite unmixed. A certain mirage would now and then rise on the desert of the future, in which she seemed to see herself honored for her surprising attainments. And so the poor child, with her soul's hunger and her illusions of self-flattery, began to nibble at this thick-rinded fruit of the tree of knowledge, filling her vacant hours with Latin, geometry, and the forms of the syllogism, and feeling a gleam of triumph now, and then that her understanding was quite equal to these peculiarly masculine studies. For a week or two she went on resolutely enough, though with an occasional sinking of heart, as if S.E. had set out toward the promised land alone, and found it a thirsty, trackless, uncertain journey. In the severity of her early resolution, she would take Aldrich out into the fields, and then look off her book toward the sky, where the lark was twinkling, or to the reeds and bushes by the river, from which the waterfowl rustled forth on its anxious, awkward flight, with a startled sense that the relation between Aldrich and this living world was extremely remote for her. The discouragement deepened as the days went on, and the eager heart gained faster and faster on the patient mind. Somehow, when she sat at the window with her book, her eyes would fix themselves blankly on the outdoor sunshine. Then they would fill with tears, and sometimes, if her mother was not in the room, the studies would all end in sobbing. She rebelled against her lot, she fainted under its loneliness, and fits even of anger and hatred toward her father and mother, who were so unlike what she would have them to be. Toward Tom, who checked her, and met her thought or feeling always by some thwarting difference, would flow out over her affections and conscience like a lava stream, and frighten her with a sense that it was not difficult for her to become a demon. Then her brain would be busy with wild romances of a flight from home in search of something less sordid and dreary. She would go to some great man, Walter Scott, perhaps, and tell him how wretched, and how clever she was, and he would surely do something for her. But, in the middle of her vision, her father would perhaps enter the room for the evening, and, surprised that she sat still without noticing him, would say complainingly, "Come, am I to fetch my slippers myself?" The voice pierced through Maggie like a sword. There was another sadness besides her own, and S.E. had been thinking of turning her back on it and forsaking it. Gutenberg Edition. End of chapter.